About a year ago, Concordia Publishing House graciously published my book called Day 7. And Day 7 is an exploration of the whole idea of Sabbath. And for years, I was telling people I'm working on a book, thinking about a book about Sabbath, and everybody kind of glazed over, you know, like, oh, you got to be kidding. How boring is that? And even my wife, you know, are you sure? Do you want to do that? But I was sure, and I kept on digging in and doing the work, and it finally came to light, and I think the product is all right. But what I'm going to do now here with the hour I have is tell you everything I did in that whole book. Not quite, but I'm going to tell you a few things and try to give you some key things, some of the salient ideas I think that came out of that, that I hope you'll find worthwhile. One of the big things that came to me when I was working on this is the idea that we have of Sabbath. And we often think of Sabbath as just sort of this weird commandment in the Ten Commandments that we're not quite sure what to do with, you know, because all the other commandments are pretty straightforward. No other gods. Okay, that's a big deal. Using God's name the right way. All right, go on, watch our language, pray, that kind of stuff. Fifth commandment makes good sense. Don't kill. Okay, got that. You know, so all the commandments you kind of tick through. The third commandment is kind of weird. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And when I was going through my catechetical instruction back in the, you know, seventh and eighth grade years, I remember being taught, my dad was the pastor, and we're working our way through the commandments, and you know how this goes. You learn the commandment, and you think, oh, that's not so bad, but then you start reading more about what it really means, and you realize, whoa, it's like fifth commandment, for example, don't kill. And you're all thinking, that's an easy one. I haven't killed anybody, really don't want to most of the time, so it's not a problem. But then you start to hear what Luther says, and he says that, you know what? If you have anger in your heart toward your brother, you've broken the fifth commandment. And if you wish ill on your neighbor or your brother, you've broken the fifth commandment. And all of a sudden you realize, whoa, this is a lot harder than I thought it was. I'm in deep here. This is not so good. I don't keep that one. But then the third commandment comes. And the third commandment, we were taught that here's what the third commandment means. You should honor the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. So what does this mean? Basically, it boils down to two things. Go to church and pay attention. And that was kind of it. It's kind of what it was. Go to church and pay attention. So I'm sitting there as an eighth grader and I'm thinking, I got that one. My dad's a pastor. I never miss a service. I can't. And so if there's a church service, I'm there paying attention. Yeah, I can do that most of the time. This is an easy one. I can keep the third commandment. And we moved on. And my whole life, I always thought third commandment's really weird. Because you see, what Luther does in all the commandments when he's explaining them is he takes the basic commandment, which seems really simple, and he just blows it out really big and wide. Fifth commandment, don't kill. Okay, don't kill. But now all of a sudden it means don't hurt, don't wish evil. And if you don't help somebody when you can, you've also broken the fifth commandment. So if I could have stopped and helped my neighbor and I didn't, sin of omission, I'm cooked. And so Luther takes every commandment and blows it up wide. But when he comes to the third commandment about Sabbath, he takes it and he makes it super narrow. So what does it mean to keep Sabbath? Go to church, pay attention. Piece of cake. So what's with that? Why is the third commandment so weird? And then some people will say, well, this is an issue of moral law versus ceremonial law. And you got to know the difference. So moral law always sticks. That's what the commandments are. Like, don't kill, don't commit adultery. And then other things like ceremonial law, that's just for Israel. Kind of comes, kind of goes. It's not a big deal. And third commandment's really kind of ceremonial law. Just kind of got left over in the Ten Commandments, and that's what's going on. And I'm not buying it. For some reason, God put the third commandment there. And my conviction is that the real point of the commandments is to always say, what's going on underneath this? And this is exactly what Luther does. Luther isn't content just to say, here's the list of commandments, go do them, because God just made up this list of rules. What's the whole point of the commandments? The commandments are God's will for how the world is supposed to work. This is a critical idea. This critical idea comes from the Formula of Concord. So if you want to check this out, it's the Formula of Concord, Article 6. And if you look in the epitome, paragraphs 5 and 6 will give you this definition. And this is for all you confessional people who really want to prove your stuff, all right? So you can go out here and start quoting the confessions, Formula Concord Epitome. If you don't know what I'm talking about, ask your pastor. He'll fill you in. So the Formula of Concord Epitome says, what is the law? The law is the will of God for how his creation is supposed to work. Think about what that means. It means that the law is not just an arbitrary set of rules made to make your life hard. The law is not just a set of rules that's supposed to show you that you're a sinner. And you've all heard this. Law, SOS. You all know this, right? SOS, what is it? Shows our sin. Yes, shows our sin. I'm sorry, I'll get my S there. I'll fix it because this is very important that you all see this the right way. All right, here we go. There, all fixed. All right, shows our sin. You all know this. Law shows our sin. So what's the point of the law? Show you that you're a sinner. But that doesn't exhaust it, guys. What else is the law for? And what's the law for, first of all, more than anything? God's will for how the world works. It's how things click. It's how things go better. So if you don't kill people, things tend to go better. If you don't commit adultery, things tend to work. If you honor God's plan for sexuality, it's a lot better. Premarital sex creates problems. It just does. It's not like God's saying, I'm going to punish you because you broke one of my rules. They're just kind of built in. It's just the way it works. The same thing is going on with the third commandment. This third commandment about Sabbath has a foundation that is more than just ceremonial stuff up here to make Israel look weird or to force them to stop working once in a while. The whole point of the Sabbath commandment is to get at, what does it mean to be human? What are we here for? And that's what the third commandment is all about. And that's why I think it's so important. It's not just about make sure on Sunday you go to church and then don't work too much the rest of the day and then you'll keep the commandment. No, it's not what it's talking about. And you don't have to go to your boss and say, well, I can't work on Sundays anymore. I have to keep the Sabbath. No, it's not what we're talking about. That's not what's going on here. And there are a lot of Christians who kind of think that's what the Sabbath is all about. Don't work on Sunday and God will bless you. That's not what we're talking about, because then you get all kinds of problems anyway. Sabbath, after all, was not Sunday. What day was it? It was Saturday. Yeah, Sabbath is Saturday. That's why the Seventh-day Adventists still do their Saturday stuff. So we just moved it to Sunday a long time ago. So if you really want to keep Sabbath, don't work on Saturdays. But see, the whole point is that's not what we're talking about. So what is God talking about? I think the clues lie in the creation account. I've become convinced over the last years that I've been teaching that one of the most important sections in the entire Bible are the first three chapters. And not because they tell us that God created the world in 6 days and the evolutionist and Darwin is wrong. That's not the big deal. Fine, we can have all your evolutionary creational arguments. I don't see too many sectionals on that. Not a big deal anymore. It's still a big deal, but that's not what the creation account's really important about. The creation account matters because it tells you what it means to be human. And my bet is most of you sometime, some of you pretty recently, have been starting to ask you really hard questions like, why am I even here? What is the point of this stuff? I'm convinced every single individual, every human being comes to the point in their life when they ask those questions. They start having this awareness that God created me, but why? What's the point? What am I here for? What am I supposed to do? These are called the big existential questions. And some of you are familiar with that language. Existential just means it gets down to the heart of existence itself. And philosophers like Kierkegaard and others like to ask big existential questions. Frankly, every single human being asks the big existential question sometime. And they will ask the question, and sometimes they get really lousy answers. They'll ask people they trust, adults in their lives, parents or teachers, the big existential questions, and they get question answers like, well, that's for you to decide. Or we each have to sort it out ourselves, and we have to kind of find our way. And the kid quickly learns, nobody knows. Nobody knows. And they start to get the sense that these aren't questions you're supposed to ask. Because if you ask these questions, adults kind of freak out. And the kids can see it in the adults' eyes. The adults don't know. And so the daughter spent his whole life working his tail off, doing stuff, and then running up and off on the weekends and having fun, or going up north. This is when I was in Michigan, up north on the weekend, because that's what life is about. And so you work so you can go up north, or go to the cabin, or go to the cottage, and you work, you work, you work so you can retire, and then you get old and you fall apart and you die. So what? What's it really all about? And you guys who are young are saying, I want to know. Because I don't want to waste my life doing stupid stuff. I want to know. And I think you should know, because the Bible tells you. See, this is what's really cool. You don't have to have stupid answers like, well, I don't know. It's up for you to decide what's in your heart. I hope you don't look there. Nothing in your heart's worth looking at. All right? Seriously. All right. So let's go to the Bible and see what we can learn here. And we're going to go to Genesis. And Genesis chapter 1 gives us the first account of God's creation. And you know how this works. Genesis chapter 1 tells you the story. And this is the one you all know. 6 days, bang, bang, bang. God does it evening and morning, and God creates. So what does God create on day one? It's right there on the screen, but you know it anyway. What's he create? He creates light, okay? Day two, what's he create? He creates the atmosphere. He separates the waters above from below. And it's like, that's all he does in an entire day? Yeah, that was a big job, okay? And so he creates the firmaments, okay? Which is kind of weird, because literally it's the idea of this kind of big, huge bowl over the earth, and there's water up there, and there's water below, and that's what was going on day two. Yeah, chew that on that one with your science friends. All right, so that's day two. Day three, what's God create? Dry land. All right, so we have 3 days where God distinguishes, separates things out. He distinguishes light from dark. He distinguishes the waters, and he distinguishes dry from wet, dry land and the waters. That's what we have on the first 3 days. Then on days 4, 5, 6, what's God do? He goes back, and now he decorates or embellishes or fills the spaces he created. So on day one, he made day dark and light. So what's he make on day four? Sun, moon, and stars. He puts things up in the sky where the light goes. Think about this. God created light before there was a sun. There was light, just light. What's the source? God. There's just light. And then 2 days later, he puts it into the sun and the moon and the stars. Pretty cool. So again, try to reconcile that with your evolutionary friends. You can't do it. The idea of a reconciled, forget it. Anyway, day four, we got sun, moon, and stars. Day five, what's God create? Fish and birds. So he fills the sky and he fills the water. Day six, what's God create? All the land animals, the stuff for the land that he created on day three. See the connections here? Is there poetry going on? Yes, absolutely. It's beautiful, poetic, potent, wonderful stuff. This is what God is doing. Now, also on day six, he creates all the land animals, including us. And that's the big deal we're interested in today. So we get verse 26, where God makes the move. And he starts this way. Then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So is the image of God kind of a big deal? How many times is it mentioned in those few verses? Count them. 1, 2, 3 times. All right. So we have the word image mentioned literally 3 times. Our image will do this. And so we created him in his image, in the image of God, he created him. When you see this kind of repetitive stuff in the Bible, it's not because the Bible is boring. It's because they're trying to make a point. It's especially how Hebrew works. Repetition drives things home. So image of God is a big deal. What is the image of God? Wow. People have written books about this. People have argued about this. People have philosophized about this. I think it boils down to something pretty straightforward. The image of God is a function that man is to carry out. The man is to image God to the rest of creation. Man is in the God spot. He has the responsibility of being the representative of God to the creation. You guys are familiar with C.S. Lewis, right? Most of you, big C.S. Lewis fans. How many of you have read Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe or heard it read to you? Familiar with it? All right, good. Cool. So, what's the whole point of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Well, it's this cool story about this wardrobe and these kids, the Pevensies, and it's all fun. But see, the cool thing that's going on here is C.S. Lewis totally gets this. Because remember, the whole problem of Narnia is it's being ruled by whom? The White Witch. She's not human. All right? It's a witch running Narnia. And in fact, when the kids first show up, remember, Mr. Tumnus is kind of freaking out. You're real, he says to Lucy, right? Because the whole question is, do humans exist? Remember, there was a book on his shelf, Do Humans Exist? It's pretty fun stuff. And so, yeah, at least that was the movie version, one of them. So you have the whole question of, where are the humans? And yet, when they show up, the kids all right now arrive at the beaver's house. Remember what Mr. and Mrs. Beaver having this conversation? Could this be the fulfillment of the prophecy? Because how many thrones are in Cara Paravel? Four thrones. Four Pevensey kids, two daughters of Eve, two sons of Adam. Huh, looks like things are working out here. But the most marvelous thing happens when I think it's Mrs. Beaver says to her husband, you know, nothing has ever been right in Narnia when we don't have a son of Adam or a daughter of Eve ruling us. You see, Lewis just nails it. What is man supposed to do? Run creation. That's his job. And Narnia is perfectly reflecting this. Things in Narnia are messed up because humans aren't doing what they're supposed to do. They're there to take control, to have dominion is the fancy old King James word. And dominion just means you're in the God spot. Does it mean you're calling the shots, being a dictator, whatever I feel like doing, I'm going to do? No, you're responsible. It's like when mom and dad leave and say, take care of your little brother. That's a fun job. Not so much usually, but who's responsible? You are. Does that mean you get to order little brother around? Try it. All right. What does it mean? You're responsible for little brother. When mom and dad come home, if little brother is filthy, who's responsible? You are. You know how that goes. This is the same idea of having dominion. It's the stewardship thing. You're in the God spot. God says, take care of it. And this is exactly what goes on. So now verse 28. So God creates Adam and Eve, and then he blesses them. This is the key right here. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. There's the idea of rule. Take it, cultivate it, and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. What are Adam and Eve created to do? Take care of creation. That's their job. Chapter 2 reinforces it. And I've got it here somewhere. Here we go. So chapter 2 is the second creation account, which starts in chapter 2, verse 4. It should have started in chapter 2, verse 1, but when they split up the verses and the chapters, they didn't do a very good job, frankly. And that's true. And don't think I'm sinning by saying that. There's nothing sacred about the numbers. They were stuck in later by some monk in the Middle Ages who got it all messed up. The story goes that he was doing the work while he was riding on the back of a donkey and it got a little bit jumbled. And so maybe that's what happened. But the point is, chapter 2, verse 4 starts the second creation account. And this is interesting because it's very different. This one we have, there was no shrub or field in the earth, no plant or field that sprouted. It was just a formless and void kind of thing. There was no man to cultivate the ground. That's a problem. But a mist would come up from the ground. Then we get to verse 7. Then the Lord God formed man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. Cool. So we have Adam comes on the scene. The Lord God planted a garden toward the east in Eden, and there he placed the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground the Lord caused to grow every tree that is pleasing to the sight and good for food. Tree of life also was there, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So, where does God put Adam? In a garden. Why? Well, let's find out. It comes up after all the river part, which we can talk about another time. Then the Lord God took the man and did what? Put him into the Garden of Eden to cultivate, and keep it. What are you here for? You're here to take care of the garden. You're here to take care of creation. You're here to work. It's exactly right. You are here to work. And I want you to hear that clearly, because you see, people have funny ideas about work. I work so I can have money to do what I want to do. I work so I can survive. I work so I don't, you know, make my parents hate me. Okay? I work so that I can have some kind of end I'm looking for. No, the Bible tells you that you work because you're human. In other words, there's a fancy way to talk about this, that work is an ontological aspect of us, which is a fancy way of saying that work is wired into your very being. You as a human being are made to work. It's God's plan. And so when God put Adam in the garden, he said, take care of it. Rule over the creation. So does that mean that everybody then has to get a farm and start planting crops and pruning trees? No, it's not what we're talking about here. Not a bad thing, frankly, I don't think, to get yourself into the dirt once in a while and actually pull some weeds and plant some seeds and see what happens. Because there's something about the connection to the earth, which I think is fundamental to our human being. So I will argue for that. But the work you do is always in light of this text from creation account. In fact, Genesis 1:28, where God says, be fruitful and multiply and take care of the garden, this has been called the first great commission. I think this is exactly right. This is the command that God gave to Adam and Eve, and he never has rescinded it. He's never taken it away. This is why you were created. So if you want to ask the question, why am I here? I can give you a straight up answer, and I know exactly what it is. You are here to serve the creation around you. Now, we can fine tune this, because how this plays out for us today really comes into the whole idea of vocation. And this is not a lecture on vocation, but I want to talk about it a little bit because it's very relevant. Vocation is this fancy term that we use that Luther really kind of brought to light and really emphasized. And we have not done as good a job as we should of emphasizing this part of what Luther likes to teach. Yes, he taught we are saved by grace through faith in Jesus Christ alone. You do nothing during your salvation. There, I'm a Lutheran. But another part of what Luther teaches is you are here as God's redeemed child, made right with God so that he can do what God created you to do. This is what I want you guys to really grasp today. God redeems you, not so that you can just go to heaven someday and in the meantime make the most of it. He redeems you to be what he created you to be. And what he created you to be is his servant in this creation, caring for those around you. And that's what vocation is really all about. It is always all about serve the neighbor. That's the heart of work. Work is all about serving the neighbor. That's why you work. You work because that's what you're here to do. And I would argue that in reality, a human life isn't complete. Work is a part of it. You guys know how to know this. And a lot of you have this kind of sense inside of wanting to be productive, wanting to do something. I know there's a sense of sleeping in and doing nothing and wasting time, and you can be very good at that. But you also have the sense of getting things done kind of feels good. And getting a job accomplished, like mowing the lawn, and you get the job done, and you walk across the lawn, and you're looking at those stripes, man, boom, boom, boom. And you take pride in it. Does that feel good? Man. And you get those dishes all done, and the table is cleared, and you look at the kitchen, and it's all wiped up, and it's all clear, and it's like, yeah, good deal. So you get it, the sense of this. This is wired into us. It's part of our very being. It's how God has put us together. We're built for this. We're built to create. We're built to be involved. We're built to work. Now, the cool thing about vocation is it's not static. Just because your dad is a carpenter or your mother's a nurse doesn't mean you have to be a nurse or a carpenter. Or just because your dad's a pastor doesn't mean you have to be a pastor, even though you kind of should because that's the seminary's whole thing. But that's another story. But the point is, vocation means you figure out what God has given you to do and you do it. This marvelous text in the book of Ecclesiastes, and it's kind of a weird one. And it says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Then the downside, for there's no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you're going. So, you know, may as well work while you can. That's the point of Ecclesiastes. But the first half is marvelous. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it. Now, vocation doesn't start when you get your first job. My first job was delivering newspapers. There's a thing called newspapers back when I was a kid. It was a big piece of paper. They put print on it, and you had to take it around to people's houses and put it in their front door. And I had a bike, and I would ride around and drop it in people's front doors. I had an evening paper route. It was beautiful. And then my second job was working at a dairy freeze, which was miserable, cleaning out the cooler where all the salad dressing went. Ugh. Anyway, I still have nightmares. So anyway, your first job is not when vocation starts. Your vocation began the moment that you were conceived. The moment you were born, you had a vocation. An infant has a vocation. Eat, sleep, poop. That's the vocation. Infants do it pretty well. And cry. That's in there quite a bit too. That's part of the brokenness, but that's there. So there's a vocation. Your vocations are given to you because of your parents, your friends, where you're born, where you're living, and then your talents come into play. So the things you're good at, the things that you're really gifted at, does that matter? Yes. That's where the parable of the talents kicks in, Matthew 25. And in Matthew 25, it's very explicit that what you've been given, you better be using. And so if you have a particular gift for being able to just like really work well with your hands and get things accomplished, you should be pursuing that. If you have a gift of compassion and you really give a rip about people and you care about them far more than a person like me does, and you really have compassion, my former students all know exactly what I'm talking about, and you actually have compassion for people, should you be pursuing that? Yeah. And if you have intellectual abilities and you just learn things quickly and things are easy for you, does that mean you have a responsibility to pursue that? I believe you do. I believe you do. If you're super sharp, you say, that's too much work doing all that stuff. I think I'll just go dig ditches somewhere. I think you're slacking. I really do. And I believe God's going to say to you, why didn't you use those talents? So vocation is not so simple as just, oh, I like doing this or I have fun doing that. It's really an issue of sorting out what has God given me to do and how do I do this to serve those around me? How do I use my work? So work is part of you. Now, having established that, there's a huge danger that kicks in here. And the danger is that we live in a culture, in a world of total work. All right? So let me explain that just a little bit. A world of total work. This means that we live in a culture that has become so obsessed with work and production, that's kind of all that matters. And some of you are already starting to taste this. You know what I'm talking about. And if you don't have a job where you're trying to perform all the time, even in school, you'll get this. Because if you want good grades, you want to get the scholarships, what do you got to do? You better work at it. You want to get a scholarship for some kind of sport, what do you better do? You better get good at it. Select team, better invest time, you better invest effort, you better work, 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 so that you can get the good job, so that you can be productive. So a world of total work is obsessed with production, getting things done, getting things accomplished, moving things forward. And you know what I'm talking about. So you have a weekend and somebody says, how was your weekend? Oh, it was great. I got a lot done. That's a world of total work. Or how was your vacation? Oh, it was good. I'm feeling really recharged and I'm ready to jump back in and get a lot of work done again. That's total work. Total work is where every single decision is run through the question of how productive will this be? What will I get out of it? What will it accomplish? Now, there is a place for production and usefulness and being efficient. No doubt about it. Being a good worker means using your skills well. But you see, if we live in a world of total work, we're missing out on a huge other component of what it means to be human. And while I absolutely believe that our work is part of our very ontology, the very way that we're wired as human beings. We're built for this. We have to be very careful because there's more to it. So we go back to the Bible one more time, and we're going to go back to the tail end of chapter 1, and then we start into chapter 2, because on chapter 1, sixth day, everything is done, but then chapter 2 starts with one last day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, and all their hosts. By the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. And that's the end of it. And then verse 4 starts the next account of what God does in the second creation account. So here we have the establishing of this day 7. And what does God do on day 7? Because he is worn out. What a week it's been. Whew. People, come on. God, we're talking about God. How much energy did God spend creating earth? None. What's it take for God to do something? God's God, guys. He's not like you. You don't have to plan, figure out the details, get everything in place. Oh, I got to get animals. I better get a whole lot of silica here. Or, you know, I need a whole bunch of carbon. You know, what's he need to do? Speaks it. Done. Does God need 6 days to get the earth created? No. No. Come on. People. God. Okay. God. All right. God is holy other. He does what he wants. What he wants does. This is God. So this is why St. Augustine was sure that God certainly created in a second of time. He didn't need 6 days. 6 days is just another story. I don't know how God did it. I like this creation account. I'm cool with that. 6 days, cool. Why did God do that? I'm convinced it's because of the sheer poetic beauty of it all. And because of all that it teaches us about what it means to be in the creation, what it means to be human, I think he's trying to teach us something about the world we're living in. That's why he creates the way he does. It's not like he needs the time. He doesn't need 24 hours to catch his breath. And God is not worn out on day 6. God is not resting on day 7 because, whoa, man, take a load off. That was a big job. What's God doing on day 7? What's the point? Rest means it's done. It's complete. And there's this cool word. He says that God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it. The tenor here is he celebrated it. He celebrated it. This is God walking across the lawn saying, check out those stripes. Look at that. Look at this giraffe I made. Isn't that awesome? Platypus. Cool. How cool is that? Look at that. What's God doing on day 7? He's just delighting in his creation. He's saying, this is awesome. This is so cool. It's very good. He likes what he's made. He made it. He made it the way he wanted. It went just the way he wanted. This is cool. And now, catch this. Who's there celebrating day 7 with him? Adam and Eve. They're a part of the party. And how much work have Adam and Eve done when it comes to day 7? Nothing, because they were created on day 6. Day 6, they were still doing their orientation sessions. They had no idea what was going on. They didn't do any work. God's saying, now here's a platypus. This is a giraffe. Okay, all right. Well, Adam has spent a cut of the day naming everybody. But so they haven't done much work. But on day 7, they're celebrating with God. This is fascinating. Their first week in existence begins with the Sabbath. This is important. Because you see, even the word Sabbath doesn't appear here, but rest does. And the root word for rest is Shabbat, which comes into Sabbath. And you see the connections. But the whole point is that rest is the whole point of what God is doing. God creates so that he can enjoy. And the key word I want you to learn here is that God delights in the creation. He just delights. He celebrates it. He's enjoying it. He's soaking it all in. And Adam and Eve are there soaking it all in with him. The whole point of the third commandment, you see, is not about don't work too hard or you'll get messed up. The whole point of the seventh commandment is you can work on 6 days, but make sure you spend one day a week doing absolutely nothing so you remember God is God. That's not the point. The point of this third commandment is don't forget why God created you. He created you to live in tune with Him and with the rest of the creation and to delight in it. So delight in the creation. That's what Sabbath is all about. And now we're getting close to the whole play thing, which is probably why you came here in the first place. Work you could care less about. You're interested in play. And if I'm going to make a room for play, you're all ears. And I'm going to do that. So we're finally getting there. So now we're getting the sense of delight. So what I'm arguing is that the whole point of Sabbath is delight. And so Sabbath really means living in tune. And when you live in tune, that's when you're delighting. So Sunday worship, pretty important. Because what's happening in worship is you're living in tune with God. He's giving you His gifts. You're giving Him praise. But you're not worshiping alone, are you? With other people. And you're living in tune with them. You're singing with them. And they're singing with you. And you're praying with them. And there you have a little microcosm of life. And then you go out and you maybe spend an afternoon with your friends hanging out. You go to the lake and you goof around on the pontoon boat and blow off some fireworks and have a blast. Is that Sabbath? Yeah, that's Sabbath. Or you hang out with your family and you have a family game night and you play games with the family. Some other guys come over and you just have a good time just enjoying life. Is that Sabbath? That's Sabbath. Because you're living in tune with the creation. You're living in tune with the Creator. You're delighting. The cool thing about Sabbath is it's not narrowed down to just this don't work, make sure you go to church, and make sure you pay attention. No, keeping Sabbath means you're living in tune. You're living in tune with God. You're living in tune with the other creation. Is work part of that? Absolutely. Absolutely. You're created to work. I'm not taking any of that back. So your work needs to be seen in a Sabbath way. You should think about your work in a Sabbath sort of way. God put me here. He gave me life. He gave me these parents. He gave me these friends. He gave me this community I live in because it's part of His plan. So what am I going to do? I'm going to grab on to these realities. I'm going to live in that reality. I'm going to serve those around me working. And maybe I work at, a lifeguard for a while. I work the tasseling corn, whatever I'm doing. I'm working, doing things that I can do at this age. And then I get older and I get more training and I get more skills so that I can use the gift I've been given to keep working and being productive and doing what? Serving others. But that's not the whole story. The whole story is living in tune with the Sabbath and living in tune with God. And so we fit everything together in this beautiful reality where we work as part of our Sabbath life, part of living in this day seven reality where we're delighting in God. Now, I don't have time to unpack all of this, but day seven is a little bit more complicated than just playing, all right? Because day seven really gets into this whole idea of delighting, living in tune, and there's a word that we use for this, which is going to sound really odd, but it's the word leisure. And leisure, most of us think about, goofing around, doing nothing, lazy. But leisure is an old ancient word, and the Greek word for leisure is actually scholia. And what's that sound like? Scholar. School. The word school comes from scholia. And so for the ancient Greeks, scholia meant living in tune, being aware, thinking about why things are the way they are, being conscious of how things have been put together, and then living deliberately in tune with those kinds of things. That's scholia. And so Sabbath has a lot to do with scholia, and play fits in here as well. Now, let's talk about play just a little bit. I'm trying to make some distinction between play and leisure because I think there is a distinction. Leisure is much more about just the whole encompassing, getting your life ordered, living in tune, finding out how work fits, how my life fits all within God's plan, accomplishing what God gets me to do. So where does play fit? Well, play is basically the sheer joy at being a human being and being in relationship. And work and play, you seem to be diametrically opposed, but they're not always so easy to distinguish which one is which. So when you're playing Little League baseball, is that work or play? It's probably play, unless your mom made you do it. That was my case. Sports, not my thing. My parents wanted me to try. I tried. So Little League, maybe that's play. High school, baseball, work or play? Starts sound like work. Major League Baseball, are they playing or working? I think they're probably working. But you talk to a lot of the players who say, oh, I still love the game. I play for sure joy. Yeah, right. And that in a few million dollars. Uh-huh. Major League Baseball manager, work or play? Now, that's work. There's no fun in that. So practicing your instrument, piano, work or play? Yeah. Are they making you do it? Or are you doing it for fun? And what about 3-day backpacking trip in the Tetons? Work or play? Yeah, well, what is it? Are you working, hauling that 40 pounds on your back? Are you working? Yeah, well, wait a minute. So is it work or play? You're choosing to, yeah. This gets complicated. Yeah, it gets complicated. Now, the point I want to make is this. I think there is a distinction between work and play. And I would say the argument really comes down to this. There have been lots of people who try to make definitions and try to get at it. I think the best way to distinguish work and play is work is always purposeful. It has a goal. So you work to get something done. So there is work has an object. It's purposeful. And what makes play play is it's purposeless. Which sounds really nasty, but it only sounds nasty because you live in a world of total work. And you have been trained to think that if I don't get something done, it's not worth doing. That's wrong. Play is purposeless. When you're playing a board game, what's the point? To win. And if you win, what do you accomplish? Nothing. Nothing. Well, I won. Sense of satisfaction. Play is purposeless. You don't justify play. If you're trying to find some purpose in your play, you're ruining it. And so what I'm encouraging you to do is play for the sheer delight of playing. And this is important. We need to play because play reminds us of the sheer delight we should have in creation. Play reminds us that I am God's creature and He's a great God and He's made an awesome world. And how fun is it just to be part of this world? So goofing around with your friends, that's good. And if your parents say, what did you accomplish? I played. That's your answer. And this was delightful to God, and I'm doing what God wants me to do. And I'm playing not so that I can have more energy when I work, and I'm not playing so that. If you're playing so that, you're not playing anymore. Play is its own end. You just do it for the fun of doing it. Now, are there going to be fringe benefits? You're playing pickleball because it's fun. I think it is, even though my wife kills me routinely. My wife and I play pickleball routinely. This is one of our things we do now because I guess I'm an old man so I can do this. But we play, in my defense, we play singles. Anybody played pickleball singles? Yeah, it's a whole new game, isn't it? Yeah, you're responsible for the whole court. It's a workout. So imagine me, okay, anyway. So yeah, we play pickleball singles. So I do it for fun, and I enjoy it. But am I getting exercise? Is it good for my cardio? All that kind of stuff. Good for my relationship with my wife? You bet. All kinds of fringe benefits. But the game is just its own thing. And the beautiful thing about play, and this is an insight that Peter Berger made, a sociologist. He said, play takes you out of an ordinary time and is a taste of eternity. Because when you're playing, the time on the clock doesn't matter anymore. What matters is the time in the game. If it's a football game, it does not matter if it's 2:03. What matters is there's a minute left and it's the fourth quarter. Right? When you're in a game, time stands still. And the other thing about a game is when you're in a game, the rules of life go away. All that matters now are the rules of the game. And so we're all players. These are the rules. And so play has this beautiful thing of taking you out of ordinary time in life and putting you into this little microcosm, which reminds us of other realities. So there are some huge benefits for play and a huge argument to be made for the centrality of play in our lives. So what I'm arguing for here is work and play are not antithesis. And they aren't also working together in a symbiotic thing. A lot of people think, I work so that I can play, or I play so I'm going to be better at work. That's getting it messed up. The better way to think about it is, I'm God's human creature. He's put me here in this world, and He's given me things to do. I'm going to do those things because that's why I'm here. And how long am I going to do them? Until I die. There is no retirement in the Christian life. There is no retirement for a Christian. And this goes completely against a world of total work. Because in a world of total work, you work so you get your retirement and you can enjoy the fruit of your labors. Show me that in the Bible. It's not there. So what do? As a Christian, you serve those around you. You work as long as you can. Now, you get old, your body starts falling apart, wages of sin starts kicking in. Can you keep on working at the same pace? No. Can you keep on doing things intellectually the same way? No. So you got to slow down, maybe retire from a job? Yeah. Does that mean now I go sit on the lake with a fishing rod in my hand the rest of my life? I'll probably just die. I've seen so many guys work for their retirement, go sit in the lake, and they die of a heart attack within a year. I've buried more new retirees than I can keep track of. And I'm betting a lot of the other pastors can vouch me and back me up on this. Happens all the time. Because what's going on here? The guy's lost his purpose. Doesn't know what he's here for anymore. Helpless, purposeless. Keep working. Your goal is not to figure out, what can I do so I can make lots of money, so I can retire and have a fun life? Get over it. Start having your fun life now. And your fun life comes not because I'm loving what I do. Your fun life comes because you say, I'm God's creature put here to serve. What a blast to be God's creature, forgiven. I know where I'm spending eternity. I may as well use this time well to serve those around me. And if you can delight in your work, the distance between work and play starts to collapse. And that's the best thing of all. All right, time's up. Thanks much for your attention. God's blessings on your time, guys.